you know, we had a pretty frank conversation that essentially amounted to, well, you guys didn't get rid of me and I didn't get rid of you, and we're back exactly where we were 2 years ago. Don't we owe it to the people of North Carolina to try to work together?
Governor Roy Cooper, your guest on this episode of the Politics Podcast from WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi, glad to have you along, as always. The Democratic governor returns to the pod to cover a range of topics, from his approach to utilizing the veto to Cal Cunningham, to some reflections on the pandemic more than a year in. The 63-year-old Cooper, now in his fifth year as executive of the state, is term limited and cannot run again in 2024. Indeed, later on, he briefly addresses some of that VP chatter. His tenure thus far has been highlighted by numerous spats, some more substantive than others, with the Republican-led General Assembly, as well as his regular pandemic briefings. And then there is Cooper's consistent, if not borderline unrelenting, push for Medicaid expansion. Medicaid is the federal health care program for people living in poverty and or with disabilities. And North Carolina remains one of just 12 states yet to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. The governor says expansion would provide care to 500,000 people in a coverage gap. Medicaid expansion is the leading reason Cooper has vetoed three consecutive state budgets, and why the state hasn't seen a new comprehensive spending plan in nearly 2 years. Still, Republican Senate Leader Phil Berger has given no indication that he's going to move on the issue. So I began my chat with the governor by asking what gives him a legitimate sense of optimism this time around.
The landscape has changed significantly since we debated this issue in the last budget. For one thing, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and so many people, working North Carolinians, have lost their employer-sponsored health insurance. Secondly, one of the things that legislative leadership has been concerned about is the proper use and investment of Medicaid tax dollars, and we are moving into the system that they wanted created, which is Medicaid managed care. And that will begin on July 4th. That transformation, they believe, will put tighter controls on Medicaid. And the third reason is that the federal government is offering significant incentives for states to do this. So there would be no state dollars required. We could reduce hospital assessments. This is a significant amount of money that can help us. So all three of those things put this in a different position.
Some quick additional context here. Last month, a $1.9 trillion COVID relief package was approved by Congress and signed into law by the president. Included in its provisions is an enticement for states that have not expanded Medicaid. Through 2023, those states would not owe any payment to the federal government. While Cooper sees it as further reason to expand, Senate Leader Phil Berger has tabbed it a short-term sweetener.
And, you know, Senator Berger knows how to negotiate. I mean, he knows that I want to see Medicaid expansion and that we've been willing to go to the mat for it. So, you know, potentially he could be positioning himself to maybe strike some kind of grand bargain at the end of the day. A lot of conversations are occurring among legislators. We're seeing an increasing number of rural Republicans who are supporting this because they see that a lot of working people in their counties don't have health insurance. They see the jobs it brings. They see the help for survival of rural hospitals that it provides. So I think there'll be more and more Republicans in his caucus who are going to be asking to do this.
So briefly to that point, and I haven't done a whip count, but I'd put money on the fact that in the House, there are a majority of House members, maybe even a majority of Republicans, who would support some form of Medicaid expansion. But you mentioned the Senate, and you mentioned a growing number potentially of Republicans within the Senate Republican caucus. Are you all actively lobbying any of those possible leverage points or linchpins that could maybe move the Senate caucus?
Dr. Mandy Cohen, our Secretary of Health and Human Resources, is leading the charge on Medicaid expansion. It's clear that she has extensive knowledge and that there is great respect for her in the legislature in both parties because of her passion and her knowledge of the subject. You know, we created a health council that had leaders from the North Carolina Senate and House, business leaders, healthcare leaders, and adopted a set of principles on getting more people covered. Dr. Cohen has been having discussions with both Senate and House Republican leadership about ways to do this. You know, at the end of the day, it will probably come down to a number of big issues. There's less negotiating room within Medicaid expansion than we talked about last year with premiums and work requirement and all of that, because I think most everybody realizes that the Biden-Harris administration is not going to give a lot of waivers for those kinds of things. So negotiations may have to occur regarding other issues that are involved, maybe other health care issues, maybe other issues that Senator Berger would want to bring to the table. But we know that it is past time. We see red states that are moving toward this. We see red states that have already adopted it. Whenever, if a state has referendum and initiative, it passes, regardless of how conservative or red the state is. So it's time to do this, and we're going to continue to work to find a way.
Let's spend a few minutes on the pandemic. A lot of us had a holy crap moment, a holy cow moment, a little bit more than a year ago. I remember I was sitting in my living room, Syracuse. My alma mater was beating up on UNC, your alma mater, in the ACC tournament. And it was when a news flash came up, coming back from a commercial break, that the NBA season had been suspended indefinitely. And just for me personally, as a basketball fan, that was my holy cow, this is unlike anything we've ever seen before. I don't think I've heard one of these from you, so I'm wondering if you had one, and a lot of us did, when and where was your oh my gosh moment? This is unlike anything you've experienced in your life.
So having conversations with Commissioner John Swofford about the ACC tournament and talking about the danger that this virus was bringing to our state and our country, having talked with the medical professionals about this beginning in February into March, there really wasn't one moment, because it was a crescendo of information that was building to the point where we knew that this was very serious, and it was to the point where I could give him the advice that I thought it was the right thing for him to pull up stakes and let's reassess where we are, because this virus is serious. And obviously it was, and we've lost more than 12,000 North Carolinians, but I think we have taken steps to mitigate. I think the actions that we have taken have helped to save lives. And I think now we are turning the corner, but this has been an unprecedented time for us. None of us have ever seen anything like it. Global pandemic clearly was not on my checklist of challenges that I thought I would have to face as governor, but I think we are poised to turn the corner and get past this and maybe even be stronger than ever.
You mentioned loss, more than 12,000 now of our fellow North Carolinians, at least, have died because of the COVID-19 virus. I'm wondering from you, what is something, someone, an opportunity, what have you lost in the last year?
So experiencing deep pain and loss of friends who have experienced death due to COVID-19, and feeling that, you know, we just cannot keep letting this happen. My deputy chief of staff, who has one of the most wonderful moms in the entire world, I have known her and loved her for years. She lost her life to COVID, and to think about how this virus has affected so many people, not just through health, but loss of job, dealing with children at home that you didn't expect, people's lives have just been turned upside down. For me personally, I've been fortunate in that I've been working, doing my job. My three kids are grown. I'm doing well, and I'm grateful that I have the drive and the energy to keep doing the things that we need to do. But just experiencing with these people the loss that they have felt, it's been tough. And particularly in the earlier days, I would talk to my friends in the Black community who started experiencing these things long before people in the white community did. This virus hit very hard in communities of color, and was talking to a person who served on a board of education. He already knew 10 people who had died of COVID, and this was early in the process. So people have been hit in different ways, but what we've got to do is turn this into a positive and find opportunity in crisis and realize that this virus has exposed a lot of challenges that we need to face anyway. So we're ready to go to work.
About 1,000 pieces of legislation have been filed across the country relating to election law, voting law, just since January. About a fourth of these, according to the Brennan Center, a left-center organization, include restrictive provisions in some way, shape, or form. Now, North Carolina has a little bit of context. Of course, you know, most people listening to this podcast and this radio program know, saw a record turnout. There was no significant, there's been no finding of voter or election fraud here. But curious, what election law changes do you deem necessary for North Carolina prior to the start of the 2022 midterm?
We should be making it easier for people to vote. I think automatic registration is a way to make sure that everybody has that opportunity to vote, making sure that there are longer hours, making sure that the absentee ballot process is easier. We should be encouraging people's participation in the process. And I think the Board of Elections during this pandemic ran as good of an election as they possibly could under the circumstances. And when you saw record turnout, even in the middle of a pandemic, you know they've done the job. And these laws that instead want to restrict voting are misplaced. And I think we know where they're coming from. They're coming from legislators and politicians who want to try to stop people from voting who probably won't vote for them. And that's wrong.
I'm going to bounce around a little bit here, try to squeeze in a couple more. You vetoed 28 bills during your first 2 years as governor. 23 of them were overridden. Then Democrats broke the supermajority. Since then, you have vetoed 26 pieces of legislation. And as of this moment, you've sustained all of those vetoes. With sharper teeth, has your approach to using the veto, when or how, has your approach changed?
Well, veto is the last resort. And my conversations with Senator Berger and Speaker Moore since the election has been about how can I and other Democrats in the legislature have earlier contribution and effect on legislation. How can we avoid the veto? We all had a discussion about the budget, and clearly we did not pass a main budget last time. I don't think any of us wants to be in that situation again. And so there are discussions going on about how we can work together to get a budget without a veto. Because once it gets to a veto, it's harder to work out. I think that the reception of my budget this time has been different than it ever has. You know, we had a pretty frank conversation that essentially amounted to, well, you guys didn't get rid of me and I didn't get rid of you, and we're back exactly where we were 2 years ago. Don't we owe it to the people of North Carolina to try to work together? That's what they voted for. We owe it to them to try to do this. I will use the veto if I believe that it's bad public policy for the state, but I'd rather try to work with the leadership to get legislation that I can sign. And I do want to be able to sign a budget. I will not if it's a bad budget, but I do want to be able to sign one. So there's a lot of work, and I'll give them credit for sitting down and talking with me and for having numerous conversations. We worked out this school bill, which I think showed that we could come to a good agreement on a very controversial issue. So we're hoping that the budget will bring the same kind of fruit.
Cal Cunningham, do you believe that he would be a U.S. Senator today if it were not for the untoward, his sexting scandal last fall?
Probably. I think he was doing well. That's so hard to predict because there's so many factors that were involved in this election. But, I think as we look to 2022, we will have a U.S. Senate seat open in North Carolina. It'll be important nationally. We also have, probably by then, an extra member of Congress looking at the census and redistricting. And in addition, all legislative seats will be up. So I look forward to the 2022 elections. In the meantime, I'm going to try to work with this leadership in the legislature to do some good things for our state.
There was this Atlantic article a couple months ago. It was a profile of you. There wasn't a whole lot new in there. My Associated Press colleague Gary Robertson would probably call it a thumbsucker, by and large. But there was a note in there about the cut the cloth of Roy Cooper could make for a good vice presidential candidate come 2024 if the leading name on the ticket is Kamala Harris. Have you been approached in any capacity considering?
No.
That post? No.
No, I haven't. And that's because I think everybody believes that President Biden will run for re-election and that Vice President Harris will be his running mate. And it's way too early to talk about things like that. I have a good relationship with Vice President Harris. She and I got to know each other when we were both attorneys general of our respective states. We worked on predatory lending suits that helped consumers, and we stayed in touch when she was in the United States Senate and have corresponded with each other and have talked to each other since she has been vice president. I think she will do a fantastic job. I plan to serve out my term as governor of North Carolina to work on improving public education, getting people covered with health care, bringing equity and fighting discrimination and fighting for clean energy. We're going to do all of those things. And who knows what's going to happen at the end of my term as governor. I would love to continue serving the public in some way, and we'll just have to see how it all shakes out.
So due respect, and here's to good health. I have heard people say that you're something of a dying breed, a rural or at least originally rural Democrat. Can you give us a Democrat, a presently serving, or it doesn't have to be serving elected office. Can you give us one Democrat from a rural county in North Carolina who you think has the chops someday to run for governor?
I'm really not going to get into that, Jeff. Maybe I can talk Jim Hunt into running again, the greatest governor the state has ever known. And I still talk to him frequently. He still has the energy and the passion. So, hey, maybe another run for Jim Hunt. How about that?
That would be surprising, but it's North Carolina politics, so nothing would surprise me. Roy Cooper, North Carolina's 75th governor. Hey, what is it you like, dislike, want us to do differently, or perhaps more of here on the Politics Podcast? Do me a favor and leave us a review wherever you downloaded this episode. Good, bad, somewhere in between. Feedback is helpful to us, which in turn, hopefully, will then be beneficial to you. Hope you'll join us again on Friday when we review some of the recent state political happenings. Until then, for the governor, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening.